I'd like to begin this conversation by talking about the role you've played in civil service reform. Could you tell me about what you do now and the jobs that brought you to this position?
Today I practice, or at least I describe myself as a public sector management specialist. I historically, I would say I trained as a management consultant, because way back in 1979, after my MBA, I joined Coopers & Lybrand, one of the legacy firms of PricewaterhouseCoopers, as a management consultant. And before that, before my MBA education, and trained in accounting and become a certified public accountant. So I've been in management consulting, but I would say in the last 20 years, more in public sector management consulting. And I really do very little of private sector management consulting. I am at the moment the chairman and director of a firm which we started last year with a few of my colleagues who left PricewaterhouseCoopers in the past. I was a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers for 4 years, 2002 to 2006, July, because they took over a firm I had founded and ran for 14 years, called KK Consulting Associates. Before I started KK Consulting Associates, I had been a director in the management consulting services of Coopers & Lybrand, but I listened through the ranks there because I started as an assistant consultant after my MBA degree in 1979. So that is generally how I've ended up being where I am at the moment in public sector management. I think we can say I strayed into public sector management because, as I say, I started in private sector, but I found myself in the 80s very much involved in addressing management issues, in particularly three programs. One was the Kenya Rural Access Roads Program, which had something like seven development partners working on it, and Daninda sponsored me to make in collaboration with an engineer, a six-month review of progress in the management of the program. And subsequent to that, I did quite a bit of work with the USAID on their support to the Kenya agriculture sector reform or other development programs, and later on in their health sector programs in Kenya. And I would say those particular three programs, the Rural Access Roads Program, funded by many donors, but with in my particular case, sponsored by Daninda, and the USAID programs in health and in health and agriculture in Kenya, in many ways shifted me from private sector management consulting to public sector management consulting. And I would say I entered into Tanzania in 1991 with the World Bank to do some reviews of public sector management as part of a public sector adjustment credit operation. That was a structural adjustment credit facility which they were trying to persuade the government of Tanzania to do. But after 3 years of work, there was still no agreement between the government of Tanzania and the World Bank. And then somehow, by coincidence, DFID in 1993 requested me, because of a time and developed some rapport with the government of Tanzania officers, to go and sort of do some work on human resources management systems, but the main responsibility was to persuade the government of Tanzania to accept their engagement and that of the World Bank in moving ahead with public sector reforms. And I suppose the rest of his history, because in 1995, then they invited me to be the chief technical advisor for the public sector reforms or civil service reforms at that time in the office of the president. I did that for 4 years. I felt after that I needed to go back to my firm in Nairobi, KK Consulting Associates, but I have continued to be very much associated with that particular reform program, and of course I worked in many other reform programs on the continent. I spent the last 8 months of last year and January this year in Nigeria, helping to develop the strategy for the reform of the Federal Public Service of Nigeria. So those are the kind of things I'll be doing lately. Thank you.
Thank you. So this interview will revolve mainly around the Tanzania experience, but I wonder whether from time to time you might make comparisons to the other countries in which you've worked or the other positions in which you've served. Why don't we begin by just talking a little bit about the challenges that faced the civil service and the public service in Tanzania at the time you started your position there?
Nothing unique, because it was, I think, in many ways the legacy of the economic collapse of Tanzania in the late 70s, early 80s, I think precipitated by the war against the Amin regime in 1979-1980, and the fact that, at least from the fact that they were on a socialist path until, we would say, 1985, it was difficult for them to agree on a structural adjustment program with the shall we say Bretton Woods institutions, or even with the countries of the West. And at the same time, it's also true that they knew they had problems, because they had done their own standards way back in 1975. Now it is established, and even 1985, President Nyerere himself had tried to reduce the size of the public service. And so they knew they had a public service which was bloated, which was not performing, which was did not have the necessary skills. The national economy was doing very badly. So, I mean, whatever could go wrong with our public service was evident in Tanzania at that particular time. I think the only thing which we can say was not that bad for the Tanzania public service was that, for whatever reason, in their socialist ideology, which was generally appreciated by most of the population, actually, you know, and maybe even the elite, because I still remember, although the economy was very bad, when I went to Tanzania, I always found it very interesting, because the public servants were not, neither the public servants nor even the elite from the University of Dar es Salaam were actually anywhere, we would say, critical of Nyerere's governance. But they knew that they needed to change. So that I think, was what was interesting about it. But everything else that we could say can go wrong with the public service, all the pathologies you would associate with a public service that needs to be fixed, were there.
Thank you. And you've led right into the next question I was going to ask, which was, in your view, what kinds of conditions created a groundswell for a public service reform, or if not a groundswell, at least what led the senior ranks of the government to say, now's the time to go ahead with civil service reform?
In 1981, a study had just been completed by a team of senior public servants, which had indicated that Tanzania's public service needed to be downsized by 8,000 employees because they were excessive. And I think that study was in the end completed with the support of UNDP. So they knew something was wrong. And as I indicated earlier, in previous years, Nyerere himself, in spite of his socialist position, and indicated the need to downsize the public service. But on the other hand, the government of President Mwinyi, which Nyerere handed over power to in 1985, but which in a sense he politically supervised, and what made quite some strides in the early 80s, in the early 90s, in terms of liberalization of the economy, they found it very difficult to do systematic structural change to the extent that it had some social implications like retrenching and so forth. For 2 years, I would suggest they got President Mukaba as the new president in 1995. One of the things which probably is not in the public domain is the, how much Mukaba is an elite in terms of an intellectual elite. You know, it's not just that he had gone to Makerere as one of the first cohort of Africans there, but he studied, linguistics and so forth, and had become a journalist trained at Columbia University. And he was quite informed by the and had been a foreign minister for a long time. And we would suggest that when he came in, it was very clear to him he needed to put the country in a new gear in terms of reform. And as I say, it was very symbolic that in his for his own inauguration, public servants got some at his senior public servants got fitted with three-piece suits or and that kind of thing, which was really unprecedented for Tanzania. So the signal was very clear from day one of his presidency that we are in for change. And it is not like he and any very clear idea of what he wanted in terms of public service. But during the campaign itself of 1995, there was quite some rhetoric for him in terms of from him about what changes were required in Tanzania. He talked about the need to make the public service more efficient. He talked about the need to decentralize. So, and he found us ready. So we just seized the opportunity. I think one of the interesting things is that at that point, and he had a very smart head of public service and secretary of the cabinet, whom he had inherited from the previous regime. And in a prelude to his coming to office, we did some background work of what changes we wanted and how we wanted a smaller government and so forth. I think the one interesting episode was trying to persuade him to establish a cabinet of 17 ministries. And I think at that time, in the previous regime, the cabinet was about 30. And then he said, no, this is a very weighty matter, and I need to establish my cabinet to advise me before I take that decision. Obviously, in a sense, he was saying he was not going to do it, because if you are going to get all these people appointed as ministers, they are not going to be the ones deciding, make a smaller cabinet. It means they will be sacking themselves. But so, there is no doubt that he was committed to reform, and we worked on a strategy, and he got very much engaged with the with the development partners. He got engaged in terms of a structural adjustment program, which was very quickly agreed within a year with all the development partners. There was a major Paris meeting in 1 year after his ascendance into the office of the presidency. And for all those things, we looked for the opportunities to get him to commit to certain things. And in terms of downsizing, for example, by the time he was going to the meeting in Paris in 1996, the first, what were they called in those days, consultative group meetings, where he sort of the government met with the donors and agreed what is the framework of policy reform and so forth. We and already agreed with him through the steering committee led by the chief secretary and other key permanent secretaries, finance and so on. We are going to reduce the public service by 8,000 as a standard in 1981 and indicated. And so he went there with that, for example, particular message. And by the time he came back, on our part, we were ready to get the first group of 30,000 out of the service. And we managed sort of to get him to persuade the development partners to, as on donors, as they were then called, to accelerate their release of funds to a fund which would compensate this 30,000. And I would say after that, the momentum for the reforms, because that looked always to be the most difficult, most other things looked a little easier after that. So that's really what happened.
And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the way the direction for this reform program was situated within the government. Now, I believe it was placed in the office of the president, and it may have migrated a little bit since then, but it's still very much a high-level kind of direction. Could you describe that a bit, and then say whether you think that kind of location in the office of the president helps this kind of process along?
Well, it did. I think there were three personalities were very key to what was happening. One was, of course, the president himself, in terms of the signal he gave. He definitely had a very smart, enlightened head of public service and secretary of the cabinet who could communicate very well with him and so forth. And then he also appointed a new head of the, what would you say, permanent secretary responsible for public service in his office, what was then called the Civil Service Department in the office of the president. And I think those three had very crucial roles to play in the whole game plan in terms of public service. And in the end, it was also clear that the permanent secretary in charge of the public service had direct access to the president. The head of public service himself was also, who also became the chairman of the steering committee, and also in very direct access to the president. And also, from my, not that I got involved with them as a trial, but it was clear that, these two had very, very open access to the president, but beyond that, they also could talk candidly to the president about the issues, about the options, and so forth. And that was very helpful for sure, all the way forward, all the way until I left. And I think I would say even 10 years later, as he left the office, that was still a very important feature of that leadership. So it is important that the people who are responsible for far-reaching reforms, for structural changes, have access to the president. But secondly, they also can be candid with the president in terms of the issues and the options. One of the big problems we have is sometimes some have it, but they spend a lot of time trying to please the president and listening to what he wants to do instead of giving him advice about what needs to happen. And I would say, to the credit of the then permanent secretary for public service, Mr. Umia Moheto, if you have not met him, and the then head of public service, Mr. Martin Rumbanga, I was very impressed because they could tell the president things as they were. They could present the options to him as we have developed them technically, and I think that is very valuable.
Thank you. Would you also describe the people who could have been considered constituents for this reform? You had mentioned earlier that maybe some of the intellectuals, people were actually quite tolerant of some of the problems that had existed before, but was there a growing constituency that you could identify and then link up with in making this reform possible?
Well, I think there was an ambition to change Tanzania on the part definitely of the political leadership. But it was not, again, it must not be lost of the fact that this was not particular to that time, because I would suggest that even as Nyerere trying to introduce socialism and Ujamaa in Tanzania, underlying the whole initiative was an ambition to transform Tanzania rapidly. And in a way, therefore, there was a national frustration with the fact that that experiment has not worked. And I would suggest that, therefore, there was a sense in which, the elite in Tanzania was looking forward to the day when this country, reassert itself. Because, again, even in its poverty, even in its economic weakness, Tanzania had sort of become a regional powerhouse, definitely in diplomatic terms. Whatever happened in Africa, it was Tanzania with its poverty was probably could only be shadowed, if at all, by Nigeria. You know, it was the voice of reason, it was the voice of wisdom for Africa. And therefore, you know, I would suggest that there was an element of that as, you know, as Mkapa came into the presidency, that, you know, they wanted to sort of regain part of their national pride, and it was never explicitly stated in that way, but I think at the back of it, if I reflect now, you know, there was a good element of that. And so in the end, I think there was sort of a consensus that the country needs to change. The specifics were not clear necessarily to the different constituencies, but they had agreed that this country has to change.
Now, in the Tanzanian case, this reform team took on very many different types of reforms, and they have happened over a number of years. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if you could go back to that original time when you're thinking about how to design this program and talk a little bit about the choice of which reforms to deploy or the sequence of reforms. What was running through people's heads at the time?
I think at the outset, when I became chief technical advisor, it was very clear to me that whatever reforms we were doing needed to be aligned to the fiscal macroeconomic agenda. And once that was clear, you know, then there weren't, you know, I mean, it, you know, there was no hesitation. And we agreed, therefore, that initial phase, we must move to help the fiscal macroeconomic stabilization. We should also try to get the mindsets to change, to be more friendly to the private sector and so forth. So it was essentially about the economics, and it was about shifting the ideological mindsets of the public servants. That was quite clear by the time you know, Mkapa was in office, and that had become very clear that that's what we are pursuing at the moment. But it was also very clear that that is not the head game. That is just but an entry point for the change that we wanted to do. So retrenchment was there. In complementary to that retrenchment, the organization and the visions refused to identify what was happening in the ministries and so forth. There was a quick and dirty job in those organization and the visions reviews. We knew we needed to fix the payroll system because there were obviously leakages in the wage bill and so forth. So a lot of things we did were about, establishing some sort of basics of fiscal responsibility in the management of human resources. That's probably, I've never thought about that, but that's essentially what we were trying to fix at the beginning.
So in the beginning, that was the emphasis. You mentioned changing the mindsets of some of the public servants as well. And I wondered if you could describe that in a little bit more detail, because several people have mentioned that to us in the course of these interviews.
Okay. We agreed. We wrote it down in some of the literature on the public service that now Tanzania was shifting from socialist and centrally controlled economy to a market-oriented economy, and the private sector was going to be the engine of economic growth. And that on that basis, therefore, the public servants needed to be friendly to the private sector and to be enabling and facilitating the public sector. So quite early on, we sort of had a number of, we created a small component of the program where we encouraged seminars to talk about this particular aspect of change. And we, at the same time, of course, the privatization program was going on. And we we were not responsible for it in the civil service reform program, but we maintained dialogue and close contact with the people who are involved in it. So we would say, and I would say also, I mean, by 1996 again, which is 1 year, in the middle of 1996, 1 year after President Mkapa came into power, we organized a major conference on decentralization along government in Tanzania. And even within that particular conference, we talked about the need for a more pluralistic approach to service delivery and so forth. So it was those kind of not so systematic, but generally targeted, aspects of communication about the change that Tanzania needed to have to be the country that that they aspired to make.
Now, some people have told us it was actually pretty hard to change the way civil servants thought about their roles, that would happen only very gradually. And one response was to create some independent agencies. This might well have been after you left, but to create some independent agencies that would issue licenses or provide other kinds of routine services that businesses needed. And those tended to adopt this different frame of mind more easily than some of the mainline civil servants.
Let me put it this way. When the creation of agencies, or agencification as some people call it, from the West it is looked at from an ideological, whether liberal, neoliberal debate. But actually, by 1995, by the time now we were thinking strategy seriously, 1996, we decided in Tanzania we are going to introduce agencies from a managerialist perspective, not from an ideological perspective. What we thought, it was obviously going to be very difficult to change government ministries very rapidly. And therefore, in our mind, and I think we articulated that at one stage, we are going to create agencies to become enclaves of good practice, of efficiency, in the anticipation that they would influence the ministries and the bureaucracy. So we had in 1996 a paper, and I believe, by 1997 we got the Agencies Act. We had a group of permanent secretaries and other senior people going to see what was happening in Britain with regard to that. So we cannot say that we are totally insulated from what we have observed happening elsewhere. But I think we're trying to rationalize differently. It was basically that we wanted to create enclaves of good management practice, and that those would influence what was happening within the bureaucracy. That's what happened. And I think from then on, I mean, it took time, and there's a process which still continues, but we immediately then went, full blast. And there was an element of that which was already happening, because I think by 1995, the idea of the Tanzania Revenue Authority as an agency had already been muted. So in a way, there were also developments elsewhere in the public service which was suggesting that this is probably the way to go. And what we did was then to develop a program to actualize it.
In the course of these discussions, did you look at the experience of any other countries? Were there any experiences that were particularly formative in the way you thought about this problem?
I think we can say we always some had some British influence, because we got some British consultants. And I can say, at least in the 4 years I was the chief technical advisor, there was always some debate with some of them in terms of how maybe some of them looked over serious in terms of what they're trying to to do with the reform program and so forth in terms of copying best practice and so forth. But I think we're always trying to temper it with a much more pragmatic perspective. At least that was my predisposition, and to the extent that I had influence, I think I tried to exercise it that way. But yes, I think the British influence was definitely there. I think later on there are people who went to, in those early years, I think it was later on that people went to New Zealand and so on. But essentially, initially, it was British influence, people going to study in Britain, coming with ideas, consultants coming to Tanzania. And I think there was one, not I think, there was definitely one or two trips to the UK Cabinet Office organized with the British government, or maybe more so with the British Council, actually. That's what I recall. Yeah.
Several years into these reforms, what challenges do you think proved most significant, and how did you address these? You were thinking about the difficulties of implementation. Were there any that stand out in your mind?
In the time I was there, I would say, I think there are two things which we wanted to fast track and see happening faster than they happened, and which are still a problem today. One was the whole issue of restoring meritocracy in the public service. And I think by 1996 or so, we are preparing a paper on public service management policy, and it was basically about trying to persuade the president to reinstate the Public Service Commission as an independent organ for recruiting and selecting and promoting public servants, and to persuade him also to relinquish or limit the number of senior officers he directly appoints. And I think essentially we're trying to persuade him that he should just be appointing permanent secretaries, and everyone below that should be appointed by the permanent secretary. I don't think that has happened in the case of Tanzania yet. I mean, and I would contrast that even with a country like Kenya, which really never, you know, did away with its public service. And I'm not saying, therefore, for that reason, Kenya is superior in terms of how, in terms of being more meritocratic and so forth. Because, again, Tanzania has its own ways of doing things, which to an extent actually ensure meritocracy. It has some checks and balances which are not so obvious. They are not so much institutional as much as a tradition in terms of how the president operates in the country.
Let's move back just a little bit. It's rubbing against.
Okay.
Thank you.
So that is one area where I would say, you know, some progress has been made, but as I say, this is more than a decade since then, but I would say it's still not a closed chapter. But again, as I say, it is not a particularly patronizing environment. And I say that deliberately because sort of I've seen all the senior appointments over the years and so forth, and I know it is not a question of the president all around getting who he prefers. There is a system of vetting within the public service, which involves, I believe, also even the intelligence service, and which the president, at least I've seen two presidents respect it to a point. So it's not, you know, it's so there's a way in which, okay, maybe national loyalty, but it's important, but I can say there's a degree of meritocracy. But yeah, there's some homework to be done. I think the other one was public service pay reform. For me, I believe I convinced the other technocrats, there was need very early to move rapidly to get good pay for senior civil servants, for professionals and technical people. And I believe by 1997, it was very clear what we wanted to do. There was obvious resistance from the political leaders. And in November 1997, we actually contracted the University of Dar es Salaam, and it was being very deliberate, to run a national symposium on public service reform with particular emphasis on how to handle the issue of public service pay. And we also had sessions which were moderated by the leaders of the trade union movement. Just because we are seeking a consensus that, you know, I mean, that what we are trying to do in terms of the compression of salary structure and so on was the right thing to do. On the background of that particular conference, then we wrote our first, the first comprehensive cabinet paper on public service pay was prepared in 1998. And it was taken to the cabinet, but the cabinet, I think, skipped reviewing it for 4 sessions. When in the end and I think there is one meeting where the president had suggested it can be deliberated in his absence, but the chief secretary then said, no, this is so weighty, it cannot be deliberated in your absence. And when in the end it was deliberated, now I'm just saying what we were informed as the technocrats, I was not in the cabinet meeting. But apparently, you know, during the first cabinet meeting after presentation, the ministers were requested by the president to go and think about this seriously so that it can be discussed in the next meeting. And I think in the meeting of November, this is after several months, in the meeting of November 1998, it was decided not to take up the policy. And in my departure note, because I was leaving in December 1998, I wrote to the chief secretary that the issue of public service pay, the war to get public service pay policy adopted, is a situation in which the battle has been lost, but you cannot afford to lose the war. But I can say, as I'm here now, I think that is a war which continues, because I don't think they have gotten the structure right yet in terms of, you know, compensation of the professional and senior technical officers in Tanzania. But, you know, there has been very steady progress, and sometimes, you know, I know a few years back, or early in 2002 or so, you know, there was a very dramatic increase for those groups, got 50% pay increase and so forth. But, you know, that needed to happen a little more and consistently, but that has not happened. So, yeah, so there are things which were started then, which we thought were very important then, but which still continue, and which in my own mind still to an extent undermine the rest of the strategic objectives of the public service reform program.
In that second case, in public sector pay reform, what do you think the concerns were that were blocking this?
I think, you know, it's not unique to Tanzania. I think not even unique to developing countries. It's just that, you know, the public service pay is generally looked at from an egalitarian perspective. Sometimes I would say there is also a lot of ignorance, even among the development partners. Some people even argue about relating the public service pay for senior public servants in Africa to the gross national GNP per capita and so forth. But actually, all those are misplaced concepts, because there is a certain extent which, unfortunately, you know, the elite exists in a global environment. And, you know, the things which the elite in Africa need actually are more expensive in Africa. They need a car. A car is more expensive in Africa than in the north, in the west. They need a house, and to construct the kind of houses, a three-bedroomed house, if they are not going to continue living in grass-thatched houses, to construct the house which was there for the colonial permanent secretary actually is more expensive in Africa than in Europe. And that is why, I would say, for example, even in Tanzania, they are still living in their own colonial governor's house. If it was cheaper to construct in Africa properly, the buildings have been different. When it comes to education, unfortunately, because education, health services, at least the public provision of those things have collapsed, it does mean, therefore, you know, to the extent that you are an elite and there are certain expectations of you from the society, you are not going to take your wife, even as a permanent secretary, to the public hospital to deliver. So, you know, so the demands in terms of income levels for the public senior public servants in Africa are as much as they are for the private sector employees, and they are not very different from those which the middle class aspires for in Europe and elsewhere. And that's really part of the paradox that, you know, our governments have not addressed in looking at public service pay issues.
One of the other things that has come to my attention in talking to people about the Tanzanian case,
yes,
is that concurrently with all of these changes, of course, you were having the devolution of some authority to local governments. And when that happened, there was a bit of a blurring of control. There were many employees were now under the control of local governments. You still wanted to be able to change attitudes, make them more effective, but no longer had that kind of direct authority over them. That probably happened more after your tenure than during your tenure, but I wonder if you have observations about what could make that kind of twin process work effectively.
Well, let me say, in 2007, I was the lead consultant advising the government team on the strategy for the new phase of decentralization. So I'm very much in the picture. And last year, but one, in 2007, I also was supporting the process of developing the strategy for the new phase of public service reform in Tanzania. So I am very much in the picture. I would suggest that actually decentralization has stalled in terms of human resources management. There has not been effective transfer of responsibility for teachers, health workers, and literally, virtually, most of the employees are still under the control of the central government, in spite of the rhetoric of devolution. And I think if you go to the ground, you find a lot of people who are, especially those who are for, political decentralization or a political decentralization perspective. That's the major frustration. And that's because the public servants have resisted transferring their services to the local governments. They have wanted to remain at the central government for two reasons. One is because of the fear of parochial patronage aspects of being under the control of the local government political leaders. So that they have been afraid of. The second one is because they consider that, or at least they are, both at the individual level and even in terms of the trade union movement, the union of teachers and so on, and the union of health workers, they consider the local authorities to be too fragile to guarantee their pay as well as their retirement benefits. So decentralization of human resource management is a key problem even today that has to be addressed by the decentralization program in Tanzania. So we can say in many ways, yeah, all the technical and front line service providers of public service who are in local governments are still under the control of the central government, and therefore they are managed by the Office of the President Public Service Management, and their terms and conditions are determined there and so forth. Yes.
Another challenge that people have alluded to is the civil service reform movement in Tanzania touched very many different projects, and still does. And some say, well, you had relatively few managers; they were spread thinly across these projects, and yet you got movement on most of these, whereas you don't have movement in many other countries. I wonder if you would talk a little bit about the deployment of experts like yourself, of senior officials within the public service, and how you managed this reform process. How often did you have to go out in the field? Was there enough manpower to do this effectively?
Well, I would share two perspectives. One is, I think, okay, one fortunate thing is that whereas in the early to mid-90s, at the time I went to Tanzania, there was a lot of resistance to external advice. We can go to a point where, at least in terms of the public service, civil service reform program, it was very much accommodated, in the late 90s. And therefore, we made extensive use and selective use of technical assistance. At the same time, we were very conscious of the need to build local capacity. And in fact, I recall that in 1996, we got a cohort of good public servants from other ministries and retrained them so that they could start working in the public service management office. And some of them have only recently left the department on retirement. So the lack, the dearth of capacity in the public service management office in the presidency was recognized from the outset. It is not like the problem was resolved. And I think the more tragic thing is that at least, again, by 1996, 97, it was very clear that the ministries are also weak. Weak in the sense that, in a lot of places we did not have strong directors where we thought we needed strong directors. But again, you went around and you found some really good people and so forth. So we can say, to an extent, yeah, the dearth of capacity was exaggerated in the sense that people had the knowledge and the skills, they just did not have the mindsets and the environment in which to deliver. And I think in many cases, that is actually the basic problem. It's not like, you know, we got people. I think there is a sufficient, there is a critical mass of reasonably well educated people and so forth. On the other hand, it was also the case that in certain areas like, information technology and so on, you know, it was obvious there weren't people. And therefore, for example, in 1996, we created a position of Director of Information Systems in the Office of the President in the Civil Service Department. We knew we did not have somebody in the public service, so we went out, advertised. We had the Civil Service Commission do the interviewing. I was present because we persuaded the British government to fund that position. And and we recruited somebody from outside who was a civil servant, but who was funded by the British government for that particular position. So the issue of capacity, I would say, is still there, but it is probably more a case of not having the right incentives, not having the right mindsets among the people who are there. I think there's a good enough group to deliver. They can always benefit from a bit of external technical advice and so forth. But, you know, it's not that desperate.
I think that those of us who've looked carefully at this case marvel that you could manage this process really with so few people, that they were pretty good, but there weren't very many of them for all the things that you were doing.
Yes, we initially started with a project implementation unit, and it was very clear to me very rapidly as the chief advisor that this model is not going to deliver for many reasons, including the fact that it does not have a good rapport, good linkage with the rest of the public service. And therefore, we moved very rapidly. By 1997, it was very clear, this is not the model we want. We want the department, because each of the departments in the civil service department, in the office of the president, or the public service management, as they call it now, has a responsibility which cuts across the entire public service. And therefore, really, the change you want to do, if it is systems, belongs to a director within that department. And therefore, you build the capacity in that department to be able to do an outreach in that. In the same case, for example, in the other department which has a major outreach into the rest of the services, what was called Management Services Department. And there again, we did a number of changes. Some of the people that were trained in 1997 from other ministries joined that particular department. And also by bringing the people from those other ministries, it meant, this reform is not just about what the office of the president does, it's also about what they do in those other ministries. And I think there was a lot of appreciation of that particular aspect of it, so that was helpful. And we also had good people. I would say also one unique aspect is how the permanent secretaries, especially in the mainstream of the public service, how much they sort of appreciated what we were trying to do. And there is also fortuitously for Tanzania, even before I went there, there is a system of where the permanent secretaries meet almost on a weekly basis. Anyway, they meet every time before the cabinet meets and goes through all the papers that will be presented to cabinet. And I would say I haven't found another country on the continent which has got that. And that does mean, therefore, you have the permanent secretaries as a college of potential change agents. They're in the middle of things. And as I say, it's unique because they meet every week, just like the cabinet. A lot of other places where I've advised this have found that very difficult to happen. But I know it is taken very seriously in Tanzania. So to that extent, then, for it's possible to move across, the government through the organ of the permanent secretaries.
That leads to my next question. As I was going to say, are there lessons in the Tanzanian experience for other countries, whether on the continent or elsewhere? And that clearly is one of them. Mm-hmm. Are there others that you think you would add to that list?
I think for me, if I talk about, I'll talk about it in terms of various aspects, in terms of entry, in terms of vision, in terms of strategy first. I think it is. In my mind, it is the case that if you have an enlightened technocracy, they should be able and they should work to influence the political leadership. Sometimes the political leaders know what they want to do, but they don't have the conviction that the risks are merited. And therefore, I think in terms of how the key permanent secretaries, including the ones in finance and so on, and the head of public service, the chief secretary, secretary of the cabinet, the permanent secretary in charge of public service, and so on, how they related to the political leadership and to the president was very important, and how they tried to influence him to make the right decisions. I think that is that is something which I think doesn't happen often enough, frequently enough in other countries of the region, and of course it has partly to do with the quality of the political leaders, but also the quality of the technocrats themselves. So I think that to me is an important part of it. But I think the second aspect of it is the stability of the service. I must say, okay, I've written this I don't know whether you've seen it, but there's an article I wrote for the World Bank as a background to the World Bank publication forging. Stable states or something like that. You know, there are 2007, 2005 publication. I wrote a background paper about the legacy of trying host, comprehensive reforms and so forth. And I emphasize how President Mkapa brought a unique sense of stability into the service. He brought smart people. Some of them he brought from Central Bank, which was paying better than others. Some of them, one or two, from outside the public service. But after that, there was a lot of stability. Among the maybe 21 or so permanent secretaries who started to serve in Mkapa's cabinet, half of them served throughout the 10 years of his presidency. And that, for me, I think was very unique. And has been helpful. The chief secretary never changed for those 10 years, inherited him from the predecessor, President Mwinyi. The permanent secretary for public service management never changed for those 10 years. There was some change, I think, at one-time change in the permanent secretary for Ministry of Finance. So those were very helpful factors in terms of getting change. I think if I had a situation where, even as an advisor, I had a new permanent secretary to advise every year or every 2 years, it would have been very different. So that was, I would say, that is another important aspect of the reason. Now, given those two, then it is very important that, you know, there is some sense of shared, especially among the key technocrats and the center of the political leadership, that there is a sense of where you are all going. And it doesn't have to be very elaborate, but there should be a sense that actually you are aspiring to make real changes, and that, you know, there's no time to waste, and that everybody, you know, should agree that what is important, it needs to happen, and so forth. And therefore, some courage of, conviction on the part of the political and the technocratic leadership is very important. Some ability to take some bit of risks. As I say, they were never able to take the real risks. I would say they have not been able to take the real risks, maybe in terms of meritocracy, in terms of pay, and in terms of, in a sense, decentralization, decentralization of human resources management. Those are some of the areas where we still have problems. In Tanzania. But I would say there is also, of course, the reason of getting a fairly large group of senior civil servants who are keen to go ahead with the reform, whatever the difficulties, including, in that sense, getting especially the key ministries to talk to each other. I think one of the great things about Tanzania is how the Ministry of Finance, from those days in mid-90s, how the Ministry of Finance and the Ministry of Public Service Management and the Department of Public Service Management in the Office of the President, how the two have related well. I would say uniquely well, in a way in which there has been a collaboration which we have struggled to foster in other countries, but which has not happened. But if, for example, there is no question if public service pay has not happened, there was no question of the Ministry of Public of Finance in Tanzania going against what the recommendations of the people in the President's Office Public Service Management suggested, and vice versa. And what they thought was good for us to do, we're trying to do. So that kind of collaboration, and I would actually even suggest that as a reason of experience, you definitely need to get the Ministry of Finance and the Public Service Management, the group responsible for human resource management, to collaborate from day one. And for the Ministry of Finance to see this as also part of its reform. And it is therefore, in a sense, instructive that I think In 1997, one of the things which I did in 1997 as chief advisor was to write a note which suggested to the Ministry of Finance why they need also a strategy for the reform of the public financial management. That the changes that they were doing, yes, they were doing okay in terms of fiscal stabilization, but they needed to go beyond fiscal stabilization. And they need to do this, and this needs also to talk to what we are doing in terms of civil service reform, and vice versa. So that's also a very important part of the lesson, getting the center of government to collaborate, to work together. It doesn't always work very well together. I know some years back, and I think if it hadn't happened, there would have been more progress in decentralization. But I know some years back there was tension between the public service leaders in the ministry responsible for local governments and the president's office for public service management. And that's part of the reason why I would say we still have that problem of decentralization of human resources management. Policy is clear and everything else, but you know the actions have not taken place, and that is the reason. So I would say that is one of the other reasons. I suppose I made a point earlier on of the extent to which you need the knowledge from outside. I mean, we are in a group of village, so you need to know how the rest of the world is going. And therefore, we sent the head of public service management to U.S. to some of your institutions. You are not strong on public service management then. So I know we sent the head of public service management, the permanent secretary to two programs in Harvard, very preparatory. We sent the chief secretary to the Oxford Strategic Leadership Program, very preparatory. And I know, I mean, those kind of things, and they are good. I mean, those are just among the two. We sent all the key permanent secretary to a number of these programs, and it was very deliberate. So, yes, the knowledge from outside was important. But at the same time, from the very beginning, we emphasized why this has to be a Tanzanian way of doing it. And we articulated that in particularly as we moved into the new phase of reform at the end of the 90s, we developed what we called the Tanzanian model for performance management. It was to be simple, and it was going to deliver. And we spent a lot of time actually articulating it, and it was at the center of the strategy for the phase of the reform in the 2000 and beyond. I know in the end it was not implemented in the way with the simplicity we designed it. And in fact, I went back to Tanzania when I was a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, because we got a contract to implement the performance management in five ministries. And we had a lot of problems because, you know, this, as far as I was concerned, what they were trying to do was moving away from the spirit of that particular model, simplicity and so on. And we were forced to adopt somehow, you know, some of the expatriates who had come in, and maybe some one or two people who had gone for studies in Europe, came back, and now they were even introducing the European Excellence Model for performance management. And we are being forced to use it as PricewaterhouseCoopers. We are arguing that that may not be the best. They were at the same time mixing it up with a manual system of scorecard, right? Okay. We wanted to use, if you really have chosen to go with the European Excellence Model, let us use an electronic platform. And we gave them, and we showed, trying to demonstrate to them how simple it was. And it was a big battle as we persuaded them to do this. And therefore, the lesson of keeping it simple, but also, in that sense, relating the models you are trying to bring to the capacity there is very important. And I would suggest that because of that parachuting of European excellence model and all the elegance and sort of exotic models into this whole thing, it never really, you know, I mean, and we have written about this, we wrote a piece as PricewaterhouseCoopers, you know, in which we made commentary on this. It never really got institutionalized in the way we wanted, and therefore part of the current phase of the program is still struggling with institutionalization of the kind of model which will serve Tanzania well in terms of performance management as sort of the integrating instrument for various aspects of human resource management and interfacing it with the budget and interfacing it with the monitoring and evaluation. That's what we had done. And it was going to be very simple, I think even the World Bank part of 1999 does reflect how simple we wanted it to be. But when it came to implementation, people saw arrogance. And therefore, keeping it simple, I think, is a very important part of it. Because if they had kept it simple, it's my own belief that they would have done their performance in the forms would be much better than they are reflected at the moment.
And when you talk about keeping it simple, it's keeping it simple with respect to the criteria used to evaluate performance, or keeping it simple in terms of the numbers of actions that need to take place with respect to the actual assessment. It is
keeping it simple in terms of how many variables you need to have it. What is the level of knowledge, competences you require, or the people who are going to use it? What knowledge is required of it? Okay, So it is both in terms of process as well as the inputs, both the human and other knowledge aspects of getting a model to work. Yes,
I understand. Mm-hmm. Any lessons from other countries that you think Tanzania could usefully draw upon at this stage? I mean, Tanzania is a bit of a leader right now.
Well, I'll say one thing for which I have no reservation, because I know I said it as I left Tanzania in 1998. And I said it to their, not to their political leaders, but to the public service leaders, technocrats who I was working with. I said, I see Tanzania as a country teetering on threshold of prosperity. And in fact, I intended to write a book on that, but I've never gotten to write it. And it's because when I would bring all the factors together, and I did not see why Tanzania was not running at 10%. And even today, I know Tanzania has not achieved a 10% rate of economic growth. But I like to believe that everything that there is in a country to enable to achieve, Tanzania has. But somehow it has not happened. And therefore my theme still is still valid. So it's something I told the permanent secretary, and I even told the head of public service as I left that, you know, you should not be surprised if I'm coming back to research on this book I want to say about Tanzania teetering on threshold of So in a way we can say maybe it's part of the national psyche, in terms and some people say so. I mean, I'm not totally bought to it, but there's an aspect of national psyche in terms of pole pole, as we say in Swahili, slowly, slowly. Don't try to run very fast. The national psyche in that, well, Tanzanians are very proud people. They are not extrovert. In terms of as a national psyche, is not exactly an extrovert side. I would say, I'm not sure, sometimes I think Nyerere was extrovert. But in that sense, at the same time, we got a national psyche in which, people, are not so overtly aggressive and so forth. And at the same time, they are not showy. And in that sense, then It means they probably do not have as much drive for ambition and so on to show off as other countries would. I'm comparing Tanzania with Rwanda, for example, maybe even with my own Kenya. You know, they could run from Rwanda to do with some degree of reckless ambition. And I'm not saying the leadership in Rwanda is reckless. I'm suggesting that, you know, in the pursuit of ambition, right? I think that is true of everyday life, even at an individual level. You know, if you are really particularly ambitious, you know, there is going to be a degree of recklessness in it. You know, I mean, you are leaving a job to, for example, you know, you are a professor in the university, and you are leaving a professorship in the university with all the respect due to it, try to become a member of parliament so that in the future you might become a prime minister. And it's not definite that you'll become a prime minister. That's what it entails. If you are going to be a professor and you want to be a prime minister, it's unlikely you move from being professorship, however eminent you are, to become a prime minister tomorrow. You have to leave it to become a member of parliament or a member of the Senate, and from there then you try to run yourself to become a president or a prime minister. And in the same way, therefore, for a country, in the pursuit of rapid change, okay, there's a degree of recklessness that has to be involved in it. And I see Rwanda with a bit of that degree of recklessness inherent in ambition, in high ambition, and with it, of course, also some risks. And, of course, the key thing about risks is not that they should not be taken, as long as you can mitigate for them, and as long as at the same time you are taking them because the return, the change which you are anticipating, is commensurate with the risk that you are taking. And therefore, I would say, you know, there is an element of that which Tanzania can do with. That's part of the reason why they are teetering on threshold of prosperity.
That's pretty good. The last question, because I know you have to go, but the last question I would ask is, do you have advice for people who play a role similar to the role you played, which was that of a technical advisor, a technical advisor from next door, but a technical advisor? Do you have advice about how to play that role well?
I think the biggest problem for many expatriates or many advisors is that they forget they are there because things are not perfect, okay? And therefore, they shouldn't go there with humility and embed themselves in the problems as they exist. They are not, you know, you should not complain. If you see things are not working well, that is what legitimizes your presence there. And if you go with that spirit, then first of all, you never get discouraged. And you can remain upbeat as long as you're doing your best. I think that is an important part of it. And to that extent, then I would say you must be humble in your communication of the antifies. Always remembering that, you know, antifies is to be taken or rejected. And, you know, you should probably even have the humility to know that, well, as a family man, I know that even my children, my teenage children, have been rejecting my advice. So why should the other people reject my advice? So, you know, you should always go with some options and try to give them best advice you can, but you should not be discouraged that it will be rejected. Because, again, if you do not have that humility, it means, therefore, people are going to find you aggressive. And sooner or later, they will find you a nuisance. So that, I think, is important. I think the third aspect is trying to understand the people you are working with. From a socio-cultural, political perspectives. You know, what makes them tick? Who influences them? What makes them, what they might be interested in, what they may not be interested in? That is not about being intrusive in terms of your relationship with them, because sometimes if maybe you get too much involved with them, that is also not very good. But you got to find a way of understanding them and a way at the same time of making sure that you do not exacerbate the internal debates within them. I think one of the common pitfalls is that there's a tendency for advisors to try to take positions. In any organization, there is politics, okay? And keeping yourself above the politics of the organization when you're from outside is very important. Most people find it very difficult to do so. And in that sense, therefore, also, you've got to be very careful not to be seen to be, an advisor for the development partners. Your interest is your client, it is the country. And they really, therefore, the extent to which they trust you is also going to influence around whether they take your advice or they don't take it. And therefore, we're not being sort of hostile, because again, I've seen other people who try to be hostile to the development partners or to the World Bank and others as a way of trying to adhere themselves to the house government. But then you are not helping that government. I found a particular case, I think, in Kenya where some two advisors who had been there for a very long time, when I had a chance to work with them, I realized part of the problem of the Kenyan government is these advisors, because basically they exist to make sure that the World Bank and the Kenyan government do not agree. And there are very many of those kind of things in different and in terms of their subtle ways of doing it. You are there to help everybody to agree, not to disagree. And I would say, I think, even when I knew people are real protagonists because there were cases of that, I tried to work to make sure that, I'm not identified with any of the groups, and that it is clear that, what is driving me is a shared ambition for Tanzania to reform.
Very good. Thank you very much. This is a wonderful conversation. I hope the first of maybe several.
You are welcome. Thank you. Well, it's interesting always to get the opportunity to reflect back, because, of course, those were also very interesting, on hindsight, they were very interesting moments of my life.